This episode of Word Balloon is brought to you by the Summit City Convention coming in May in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Details coming up later in the program. Welcome back to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. John Suntress here, and today we welcome back Steve Englehart. Steve may be best known to this audience as one of the great Bronze Age writers at Marvel and DC, and really his work goes up through the 2000s as well, writing such titles as Batman, The Avengers, The Defenders, Captain America, The Justice League, Doctor Strange, and many others. I mentioned Doctor Strange last because Steve is back in the world of magic in a series of novels that have begun for Tor Books. There's the reprint of his 1980 book, The Point Man, which introduces the magical character Max August, and his new sequel, The Long Man, which picks up the story 25 years later. The series is a great blend of magic, political intrigue, and men's adventure. Talking to Steve gives us the opportunity to talk about some of his older comic stories, like his classic Secret Empire arc in Captain America, and compare that to the current controversy that involved Ed Brubaker's story and the Tea Party movement. But we also look back at Dark Detective. Steve Englehart's story that began in the 70s had a second chapter written in the early 2000s and an aborted third chapter by DC. And Steve's uncomfortable feeling that there are a lot of similarities to what he had planned in that arc to what became basic plot points in the Batman Dark Knight film. All of that coming in just a bit, but first, let's talk about The Point Man and Long Man, the two new books out this week from Tor Books, Steve Englehart's latest novels.
I was a DJ back in the 80s and 90s. I appreciate your lead's former occupation.
Yeah.
Were you ever a DJ?
I was in college. I was on the college radio station, and through that, I went to school in Connecticut, and I got to know a couple of guys who were professional DJs in Hartford, and so had a sense for how it worked, you know. But I never was a professional in that field.
The Point Man was reasonably contemporary.
Yeah.
Maybe 10 years in advance. It starts off in the early 70s, and given your background with Doctor Strange, I kind of see some kinship with Max August and Stephen Strange, although maybe this would have been some of the paths Stephen Strange would have taken had he been a DJ instead of a surgeon.
Well, maybe. I've never thought of him as anything other than a doctor along the way, but... No, I just wanted a guy who was plugged into contemporary life, and a DJ sounded legitimate for that. I mean, more than just, you know, a guy who works in an office or does whatever. The book was also, as I've said, it was also takes us places in magic that I couldn't go in comics. I mean, basically sex magic. I couldn't do much about sex magic in comics.
Sure.
And DJs have been known to have sex, you know.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, so I just sort of threw all that stuff together.
I'm a big fan of the men's adventure genre and, you know, loved Mac Bolan and Remo Williams and all the various characters that kind of came. And there's a flavor of that as well in this book, obviously.
Yeah, well, it's an adventure. And it's not a comic. So, I mean, if you're not going to do a guy in a costume who can fly or whatever, you basically get back to Remo Williams or Jason Bourne or, mm-hmm. or you know, somewhere along that line. What I tried to do with The Long Man, I mean, once that Max is completely committed to his new lifestyle, one of my thoughts there was, you know, what if Jason Bourne could do magic? One of the controversies, so I don't know if that's the right word, but when The Point Man came out in the first place, the first edition, the Dell edition, listed it as Dell Fantasy, and I said it's not a fantasy. You know, I mean, it's got magic in it, but it's written to be, you know, if real life had magic in it, how mm-hmm. would real life work? I mean, I came at it from the standpoint of real life plus magic, as opposed to fantasy per se. And so when they did the second printing, when it went back to press at Dell, it was listed as Dell Fiction, and that's been kind of the tipping point for this all the way through, that it's like, it's just like the world we live in, except it's got this one little extra thing, and I'm even pretending in the course of this book that little thing is part of the real world, i.e. magic. But that's been sort of a losing battle over the years, and the new books, you know, are sitting in the sci-fi fantasy section of the bookstores, and I just, you know, now I accept it. But I still say that it's like if magic were real, you know, if people really could do magic, how would that work? And how would, you know, and one of the things I tried to do, I mean, this is getting a little farther ahead, but it's spinning out. When I do the magic in these books, I'm calling it CSI magic. It's kind of like when CSI, you know, comes up with a piece of evidence, they go, we're going to stick it in the Wiebelfritzer, and then we're going to run it through the Hydroline whatever. And you go, oh, okay. You know, I don't understand that, but they can do that. And that's kind of what I tried to do with magic here, that when he does magic, he sort of explains it to you. And at some point you may go, well, okay, but hopefully it sounds real. You know, it's like it's real magic, whatever that means. What it means is that it's fantasy, but what can I do?
Well, the people sound real and they feel real. I feel like this is the same kind of world that Doctor Strange was in. Not, and again, more grounded in the real world, but I can't help but feel like Max's mentor has a kind of Ancient One kind of quality to him. Again, a man who was contemporary and hid the fact that he was close to 500 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me the differences. I mean, did you, you know, and also, before you do that, let's go back to when you first wrote this book. You mm-hmm. said that you had the ability to include things like magic and sex, things you couldn't do in comics. But really, yeah, what was the impetus for coming up with the Point Man?
That was pretty much, I mean, that was really a lot of it. Well, for one thing, you know, I had just done the first Dark Detective Batman stuff.
Okay.
And really felt like I'd hit a high point. I mean, I felt right at the time that I had hit a high point in what I was doing. And then I left the country, so I didn't even hear what other people thought about it for a long time. But I just felt like I had really, you know, gone, hit a high point in comics, what can I say, and in my, you know, in my career in comics, mm-hmm. and wanted to try something else, wanted to go do something else. And so there was that, you know, sort of personal, professional desire to move on to a bigger field of endeavor. And the other was the fact that I couldn't, you know, I sort of hit the wall. I'd really taken Doctor Strange into the land of trying to do real magic, different from what I was saying before, and that it wasn't, you know, it was the Marvel universe. It wasn't, and this will answer your other question too, but I mean, it wasn't our universe, it was the Marvel universe, and it was, you know, it was established that there were other dimensions, and mm-hmm. there was the Dread Dormammu, and there was, you know, Baron Mordo, and all this kind of stuff was all there for Doctor Strange to mess with, none of which was there for Max August to mess with.
I understand.
Some things, as you say, you know, follow similar paths, but he started out in the real world. That was, you know, that was the deal. So the fact that there wasn't a pre-existing magical universe with lots of established characters in it was one thing. And the other was, in trying to do Doctor Strange, trying to take Doctor Strange into the real, you know, the realms of real magic, what people believe magic to be, and that's what I tried to steer Doctor Strange towards. So I kept him in the same universe with Dread Dormammu, but I was trying to do stuff that hewed closer to real magic. One of the underlying tenets of magic is the energy involved in it, and the energy involved in it quite often shows up in sexual energy. And that wasn't, you know, I couldn't get there in comics. So it was like I wanted to try something new, and at the same time I wanted to go to places that I couldn't get in comics. So all in all, I decided it was time to write The Point Man.
Politics play a big part in both books as well.
Right.
And I appreciate seeing the evolution of politics from a 1980s standpoint in the first book. And then again, as you come to this sequel, including the changes. And also, obviously, bridging the time periods in the second book and kind of filling in the gaps of what happened right after the events of the first book. And I think you do that well. And it's interesting to see you again, take on political issues in your writing in these men's adventure stories.
Well, once I had said, you know, I'm going to try to set this thing in the real world, I mean, in terms of, like, not the magical world, but the real world,
mm-hmm.
That puts me in the real world. You know?
You can't ignore it.
And the other thing was the time changes, that indeed the bad guys in the 80s were the Russians. Those were the bad guys. Anybody who was around in the 80s knows that those were the bad guys.
Absolutely.
Well, that all went away somewhere in between 1980 and now. And, you know, looking around, the guys that I don't like at the moment, are the people who are bottling up health care, the people who are staging wars in Iraq that they don't have to have. I mean, that they have to have, but the rest of us don't have to have. That kind of stuff is what seemed to me to be the problem with the situation today. And so if I'm going to write around the real world, then that's the kind of stuff that I'm going to be writing about. In terms of bridging the gaps, when I thought of this idea of doing a sequel to a book that was 20-some years old, I had no idea that that anybody would want to republish The Point Man. So I had to make sure that The Long Man stood on its own, that you could pick it up, and as with any sequel, previously on CSI or, whatever, any sequel, you have to start off by saying, here's what you missed, and I tried to do that as gently as possible, but there, a lot of stuff had happened in the meantime, and all of it's relevant because it all continues to play out. So it was an interesting writing exercise to sort of start off a book by filling in the last 20 years, because I needed to do it, and at the same time not just make everybody throw up their hands and run screaming for the exits, So, but yeah, the whole point of this, and I'm really glad that both of these books are out now. I mean, again, I'm glad that Tor decided they wanted to reissue The Point Man.
Sure.
That makes it work out better, I think. But the fact that this guy, he's really the same guy in that he of course has grown and changed internally, but at the same time his self-image and his physical image have not changed since this time, and yet the world around him has changed drastically. I mean, again, the world in 1980, very different from the world of of now.
Certainly.
And seeing that same guy appearing at both times is the coolest part of the whole series, as far as I think. We live in the time we live in, and I mean, you remember the 1980s, and you remember yesterday, and you don't really think, oh well, those are completely different, unless you sort of stop and look at it. But I mean, generally, you go, well, I'm just I'm living, and it's life, and Obama's president now, and Reagan was president then, and whatever. But really, pretty different times, and it points out the differences in time, and each book as the series goes forward is going to be set in its current time period, and that's what I want to do, is watch Max sort of motor through time periods, like he's traveling from East Coast to West Coast, driving through states or whatever. I mean, each reality is different, but he's the same. And
sure,
I'm just sort of, again, spinning out from you start off on one direction here, and pretty soon everything's connected.
Forgive me, Steve, because I know that this is its own animal, but much like a Captain America who was fighting the Vietnam War back in the 60s and was fighting World War II in the 40s and is now, asking the questions of the, Superhero Registration Act, it's still that same Steve Rogers. And
uh-huh.
And I can't help again but notice the similarities. You have found an interesting way to, much like Batman, Captain America, the various comic book heroes that you've worked with that do maintain that same age but have to deal with the times changing and
mm-hmm.
still be the constant character, or adapt their views on the changing environment around them. You've found a way of doing that as well, and keeping your character forever young with the wisdom of, experiencing all this stuff.
Yeah, well, I think the difference, I mean, you're right, but the difference, but where you're wrong is,
please,
in any of the comic book series, Batman, Captain America, they live at their time and they adapt to their time, and so does everybody else around them.
Sure.
In these books, this is the only guy that's doing this. I mean,
right.
One of the problems is, you know, his friends from the 1980s are now, you know, 20 years older, but he's not, you know. And that's another thing that I like to play with on this, that traditionally stories about immortal guys are that they're 500 years old and they, you know, and they did this and they did that. I like the fact that he's 35 years old, and he's having to come to terms with how exactly to make this work. But also, in traditional stories about immortals, people have seen a lot of stories about immortals, and I think everybody knows how immortals get along, which is, you know, every 20 years they kind of have to drop out and go someplace else and become somebody else,
right,
and make a whole new set of friends.
Yeah, hide their identity, absolutely.
Right. Well, that, you know, that's all well and good, but it's not so easy to do after 9/11, you know? I mean,
sure.
Now there's a whole lot more security involved. It's not so easy to get a different Social Security card, get a different driver's license, show up out of nowhere and create an identity. So he's got problems just from living in the 21st century that guys before him doing this kind of thing didn't have. I don't know. There's a lot of aspects. In the same way that I say that, you know, that I'm treating magic as if it were real, I'm treating immortality as if it were real, which basically boils down to the idea that I have to think like that. You know, I have to figure out what it would be like to be immortal. It is my firm goal to kind of turn that into something I can actually use for myself, but until that point, it's just a storytelling conceit, but kind of interesting to think about, you know, how you would pull this off in this day and age.
Well, and I think that espionage writers face this problem as well, and, you know, think of the storytelling methods that pretty much stayed solid from, say, the 40s through the internet age, where, you know, wiretaps and counting on the postman to be late. And just, as you say, this lack of interconnection that existed before the internet, I think you're right. You know, Mark Miller, the comic book writer, has his movie Kick-Ass coming out, and it's all about somebody really trying to be a superhero in this day and age. And I think, like you say, you're trying to do this as well with immortality and really, you know, trying to put these in real-world rules. That's what makes this interesting, and I think it is a different set of complications, both for the character and for you as a writer. No, I think this is a lot of fun, and there are two books if people haven't read The Point Man. You know what was awesome? I looked on Amazon, and it was so cool to see that Richard Corbin had done the original cover for The Point Man.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah.
And your new artist, actually, I think is a nice cover artist. It has kind of a graphic novel kind of cover to it, at least it looked like from seeing the covers online.
Right. Yeah, it's you know, Tor was not unaware of what my reputation might be coming in, so they definitely thought, you know, of a line art comic book kind of artist, but there's a lot of that stuff out there now that isn't in comics. I mean, I think maybe since comics don't sell all that much anymore, a lot of guys who might be drawing, you know, the Avengers right now are working for the New Yorker instead. And I mean, you know, if you look at the New Yorker, to take an example, there's a lot of stuff that looks like it could be comic book art, which is now, you know, illustration by contemporary New York publishing standards. And that was kind of the thing here, that they got Frank Stockton, who does a real nice job. And it's not really comics, but it's not that far from comics. You know, I mean, it's easy to see the connection. So
I know writing is writing, and I'm glad to see you've got new material out, and I urge people to check these books out. But I think people are going to wonder, are you done with the comic book world? Are you do you want to maybe come back? Because it seems to me that a lot of the things you couldn't do, you know, 20 years ago, you can do now, and that there are publishers that, you know, there are more publishers, I think, that are willing to try more adult fare. And I mean, you know, there are a lot of comics where anything goes, whether it is politics, sex, violence, whatever. Maybe not at the big two, but you know, again, well, there's Vertigo and things like that. I don't know. Would that ever interest you?
It's hard to say. I mean, the answer is probably no, but it's the thing is, I like doing comics, but I like doing comics the way we did comics back in the Marvel age, which basically boiled down to complete freedom. I mean, you know, all this stuff that we, you know, when we've mentioned, oh, you did Batman, you did Captain America, you did Doctor Strange, whatever, that was all, they just said, here it is, go do it. And I did what I thought would be the right thing to do, and you know, seems to have worked out, and I don't, it didn't have to be any more complicated than that. So my last, you know, my last interactions with comics, which were admittedly with the big two, there's a lot more bureaucracy now. There's a lot more, you know, tell us, you know, give us a proposal for what you're going to do for the next 12 issues. I find that to be completely deadening. I mean, you know, if I sit down and I work out what I'm going to do in issue number 12, then by the time I get to issue number 12, that stuff is so old and so unspontaneous that it, you know, it really doesn't interest me very much.
I see.
The creativity has been drained from a lot of it. And again, I'm not saying everything all the time, but I found it just not interesting. And that was coupled with, you know, having Dark Detective 3 shoved into the Dark Knight movie without anybody telling me about it, which was pretty gratuitous and you know, didn't endear DC to me. So, you know,
well, yeah,
at some point I said, enough of that, I'm going to go write novels. And, you know, the great thing about novels is the freedom to be spontaneous again. My editor, Jim Frankel, on these books, very good editor. I mean, when he comes back with editorial comments, they are very spot on, I think. But they also come with his instructions to ignore them if I feel like it. You know, it's like he says, here's what I think, now you decide. And so at the end of the day, the book that you get is pretty much the book that I wanted to write. From the heat of inspiration, you know. I mean, there's no, even though books take a whole lot longer to write than comics, I feel like I'm a lot more in the moment in the book business now.
Time to take a moment to talk about a great convention coming up, put on by our friends at InStockTrades.com and DCBService.com. The Summit City Comic Con. It's coming May 22nd, a one-day show, $10 for admission, an intimate artist-focused show, and hosted at the Grand Wayne Center in downtown Fort Wayne. It's a beautiful convention house, and it's going to be a great convention. The guest list includes Art Balthazar, Mike Norton, Matt Kent, Tim Seeley, Robert Atkins, Nate Powell, Steve Bryant, Chris Burnham, Jim Rugg, Ryan Stegman, Katie Cook, Dave Wachter, and many more. Plus, there'll be publisher presence and involvement from Dark Horse, Boom, and Top Shelf. It's going to be a great day, and we hope to see you there. Word Balloon's going to be there. I know a bunch of other podcasters will as well. The Summit City Comic Con in Fort Wayne, Indiana. The one-day show is May 22nd, and it's only $10. It's going to be a great time. I hope to see you there at the Grand Wayne Center in downtown Fort Wayne, May 22nd.
You know, it's funny, you mentioned Dark Detective 3, and reading your email again, I was surprised, and I have to say, it didn't occur to me, watching the Dark Knight film, how similar it was to a lot of the events in Dark Detective 2.
Right.
And to remind people, Rachel in Dark Knight is going over whether she should, you know, be with Bruce or be with Harvey Dent, who's run, you know, who is district attorney, and there's, you know, a political edge going on. And in Dark Detective 2, Silver St. Cloud is going through a similar situation. Does she stay with Evan, the man that's running for office, or go back to her long-lost love, Bruce, who she's reconnected with and had to leave Gotham to forget? And, you know, I'll admit, I didn't realize that. I can appreciate, as a writer, you seeing that and going, hey, wait a minute, that looks way too familiar. Were you given a check for either Batman Begins or Dark Knight? I know a lot of other DC creators were.
Right. The answer to your question is no, I was not. And I am aware that other people did get checks. There's a couple things in there, I guess. One, I hadn't really noticed until I was putting together a little bit about it on my website that Harvey Dent in the movie looks exactly like Evan Gregory. You know, I even watching the movie, I hadn't necessarily internalized that, but when I came up with a picture of Aaron, whatever his name is,
Aaron Eckhart,
yeah, he looks exactly the same. The same hairstyle, the same, you know, everything. The actual, so there were similarities. There were similarities. The other thing, but the actual thing was in Dark Detective 3 that never got published. There's a whole sequence in there in which Two-Face, in my story, Two-Face goes to Kevin, who is badly, you know, he's had his arm and his leg amputated in the previous thing. And there's a whole sequence in which Two-Face says, you really need to come over to the dark side. They're never going to accept you now that you're so damaged. In the Dark Knight movie, it's the Joker who goes to Harvey Dent and says, they're never going to accept you. You have to come over. That was lifted pretty much straight from the unpublished Dark Detective 3.
Wow.
DC has never wanted to, you know, to publicly admit where all this came from. You know, I mean, they went 20 years before asking Marshall and me and Terry to do another one. You know, for many of those years, I thought, well, this isn't good, but I, you know, it's a big corporation and what do I know? But at least, you know, with the first Batman movie, you know, there was plenty of press about the fact that it was based on my stuff. And
yes.
I got a paycheck later for working on the adaptation of my stuff.
I see.
I didn't get a gratuitous paycheck, shall we say. But this time around, they didn't even ask. I mean, they sort of deliberately, they didn't tell, you know. I didn't know about it till I got to the movie and saw my stuff on screen. So it was a pretty... You know, they don't want to be obligated to anybody, you know, for that stuff. And, you know, I'm not the only one who's had that happen to them in one form or another. I don't think Alan Moore is all that thrilled about a lot of stuff either. But, I became aware that other people actually got, other people whose stuff was not directly in those movies got paid. So, you know, whatever that's all about,
it's confusing. I mean, honestly, because really, I was pleased to see that I think a lot of creators were compensated for both Batman Begins and The Dark Knight, because there were elements of previous stories that were pretty obvious that, oh, yeah, that came from Jeff Loeb, that came from Chuck Dixon, that came from, you know, name a Batman writer. And
Neil Adams told me he got paid.
There you go, exactly. And so that's the surprising thing. The other thing, as you say, you know, the what you call the original Dark Detective, and a lot of fans called the Laughing Fish story, the original
right.
Silver St. Cloud story, was such a popular story and was such a seminal story. As you say, it was – I know that for the longest time, it was much more clearly in earlier treatments of the Tim Burton film, or what became the Tim Burton film maybe. I mean, it seems like your story was the one they kind of threw around. It was certainly in the Batman animated series, the whole Boss Thorne story was right there.
Right.
So, I mean, were you compensated for that?
Well, as I say, I got a check for working on the movie.
Okay.
But not as it turns out. I mean, this is I've never really opened up this can of worms. It's just something that I live with. But I found out later that by Writers Guild rules, the whole arrangement with me broke those rules, and I should have been paid a lot more than I was. But again, I was just a comic book guy. I didn't know. So
sure.
They, you know, they were taking advantage of me from the start, basically. But yeah, every script for the Tim Burton Batman movie until the last one had Silver St. Cloud in it as the girl and Boss Thorne in it as the guy. And when it came time to film it, they changed the names to Vicki Vale and Boss whatever Grissom, I think.
Right.
And
Jack Palance's character. Okay.
And you know, and started down this road of sort of pretending that it just sort of fell out of the sky somehow. You know.
Crazy. Well, that sucks, and I feel for you. And like you say, it's a cautionary tale that a lot of other writers tell as well.
Are you going to seek any type of recourse through court or anything? I mean, you know.
I think Steve Gerber with Howard the Duck and people who have
Marv
gone
Wolfman.
Down that route have not gotten very far.
Yeah, Marv Wolfman with Blade. I know
exactly.
That.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Although I think they eventually, you know, gave Marv a credit and some money. But, but I don't know. I don't say that for sure. I mean, I think that's true, but I wouldn't swear to that. But in any event, I don't, you know, suing Warner Brothers doesn't strike me as a profitable.
I understand. God, you know, I remember the story when Art Buchwald, the Washington writer, took Paramount Pictures to court over Coming to America.
Right.
Actually won.
Right.
And then when it came time for the settlement, the Paramount Pictures accountant said, gee, we made no money off of that movie that made $300 million, apparently.
Right. Absolutely.
So,
well, that's an old Hollywood story. I mean,
sure.
I, for all I know, they would claim that they made no money off Batman. I think that would be a little tough to do. But,
probably.
But, you know, as I say, it just – it is what it is. I mean, at the moment, basically, I just – I write – you know, I'm – walked away from comics, and I'm happy to be away from comics.
Well, I'll tell you, I'm sorry that, you know, things like that happen, because you've written a lot of great comics, and to change subjects, I wanted to ask you about the current Captain America controversy, because it reminded me of your time on Captain America and the Secret Society. Captain America 602 featured a tax protest. There were teabag signs. And I know, you know, Ed Brubaker and I have discussed the current Captain America writer, your run, and he has said on record that, you know, he was a big fan of a lot of the things that you did with Captain America, and I think we can see that a lot in his run, and he's the first, I think, to admit that. So I was wondering, what you thought of that controversy, and did you have, as you say, you were allowed to write the stories that you could, that you wanted to back in the 70s. Did you have any flack about the Secret Society story? Refresh people's memories about the way the Secret Society story kind of unfolded.
Well, it was actually Secret Empire, but
excuse me.
But who's counting? It was
shame on me. Go ahead.
Well, it was just, you know, I was spinning out this story and started to get into conspiracy stuff, and while I was in the middle of it, Watergate actually happened, where, you know, the President of the United States was accused of burglarizing the Democratic headquarters, and he tried to cover it up, he tried to get rid of it, it wouldn't happen, and so it was this vast soap opera being played out in real life on the national stage. And, you know, I'm writing Captain America, and I thought, well, there's no, you know, I mean, if Captain America is supposed to exist in America, I can't be doing the Yellow Claw here, you know? I mean, I got to do something that reflects on that. And, again, there was nobody to tell me that I couldn't do it. And when I did it, nobody came. I mean, seriously, nobody from Marvel said, that was a bad idea, you should have checked with us first, you shouldn't have done it at all. No, they just said, you know, great comics, you know?
Sure.
And that was the attitude, which is the attitude that doesn't exist anymore. But so that was tying Captain America into America, and you know, ever since Bush and Cheney, people have been saying to me, well, if you were writing Captain America today, would you do something? And I'd say, sure, you know, he would definitely have something to say about all this. And for years and years, you know, nothing happened. Again, I'm not following comics, so I'm not saying I couldn't tell you why nothing happened. I'm not laying any aspersions on anybody. You know, it's like it didn't happen. And then it did. And I, you know, when I first heard about the whole teabagger thing, I thought, good for those guys. You know, good for them for doing that. And then I heard that they'd apologized. And I thought, how lame is that? You know, why would you want to apologize to a bunch of crazy people? You know,
I hear you.
I mean, that's my comment on it. I'm glad they did it. I'm sorry they backed away from it.
Well, as you say, they don't have the readership that they used to. So I think when we live in this 50-50 society, and for better or for worse, I mean, I think I understand from a market standpoint their fear of offending potentially half the audience. Because I'm surprised sometimes by some of the people that see merit in the teabagging side, but
and it's certainly not 50-50 though. I mean, you
I
know,
agree.
The support for teabaggers is like under 20%. I mean, the non teabagging side is much more the mainstream in America. I mean, polls show that all the time. They just there was something the other day from Newsmax, which is a real right-wing lunatic organization, and they ran a poll, and it turned out that people didn't think much of them. So, you know.
Okay.
These people, you know, they're crazy, and they're a minority, and which, you know, doesn't mean you get to discriminate against them because they're not a minority, but neither do you have to apologize to them because they're crazy. So
no, I understand that. And, you know, I'm sorry and would never force you to read current Captain America stories. But really, I think Brubaker has done a great job, much like you did in the 70s, in terms of the real estate crisis, the oil crisis, everything, and the the manipulation of the oil market to create a crisis. Mm-hmm. I mean, he did cover all that, I think, since he's come on the book, and Captain America has become a political book again, despite Marvel's protests to the contrary, and I think when challenged on it. And unfortunately, I think a lot of it wasn't just teabaggers that took up the cause. I think, you know, it kind of became red meat for a day for, I think, Fox News and the right wing pundits in general. And it's just so easy to say, oh, God, it's nice. You know, look at Captain America. You know, I thought he represented all of us. And he does. But you know what I always go back to, and when we discussed it on a few podcasts with other podcasters, I went back to our first conversation when you said Captain America was a New Deal Democrat.
Yeah.
And that always stuck with me. And also, it always seems like he was, no matter who was writing him. And by the way, Democrats can be wrong too. And
sure.
And I believe Steve Rogers has had times where he's disagreed with Democrats or whomever is in the
sure.
office.
I'm talking about crazy people.
There you go.
I'm not talking about people who have come to sincere
right.
Calculations based on their, you know, I mean.
Right, you're not talking about Republicans in general. You're talking about specifically the teabag movement.
Right, and we started early in this podcast. I was saying that, you know, the guys that Max August is up against are the people who are manipulating things behind the scenes in America, and you know, covering a lot of the stuff you just mentioned for this. And let me say before I get away from it, whenever people talk to me about Captain America, they pretty generally say Ed Brubaker's doing a great job. So even though I don't read the books, I tend to assume that Ed Brubaker's doing a great job. You know what I mean?
There you go.
But as far as, you know, The Long Man, which is the book that's out now,
yes.
takes place when Bush and Cheney are in office.
Okay.
And they, you know, when Max doesn't like the way things are going, there's the natural inclination to think, well, okay, so there's a straight line to be had there. But in the book after that, The Plain Man, which will be out next year sometime, it takes place during the Obama years. And we find, you know, what do we find? Well, the war in Iraq is continuing. People are still being put in secret prisons.
Yes.
You know, there is no health care at this point. I mean, it becomes clear, and this is one of the great things of the books traveling through time, in effect. It becomes clear that these guys are in it for themselves, and it doesn't really matter, you know, whether it's Republicans or Democrats who are in the White House or anyplace else, because these guys have burrowed into the government and they operate around the government, and all of which I think is fairly accurate. So I'm sure that, you know, on some days me and a Tea Party guy, a tea bagger, could say, well, yeah, you know, none of us think they are, you know, but I try to be a little more nuanced and a little more, again, I'm trying to write things the way they really are, not the way, you know, what can I say? I mean, I'm sure the craziest guy out there would say, I know how things really are.
Sure.
You know, the proof is just in the books. I mean, it's like either I'm making sense or I'm not making sense. But, you know, why are we still putting people in secret prisons without trials? I mean, I thought we were going to stop doing that. But, you know, so.
Well, I'm with you. And I want to end on a note that people need to look for the repackaging of the Doc Savage Marvel stuff from the 70s. I guess DC is...
Yeah, that's the weirdest thing.
Yeah.
When I heard that they were going to reprint all the Marvel stuff and DC was going to do it, I'm like, what?
Well, I guess, you know, they've got the license now, and I guess they have access to it, because I guess when the license, you know, runs out, the material goes back to whoever owns, you know, Condé Nast these days, or Street
Smith. I
guess
so, yeah. I mean, I had no idea. I mean, but... Yeah.
Well, and you know, the old Conan stuff gets reprinted by Dark Horse these days. So, yeah, you know, I mean, it's it is interesting. And yeah, it is the last thing you would expect is DC to come out with some Marvel material. But it's good to see, and it seemed like, going to your website, you had a good time for the limited time that you were writing Doc Savage. You did a few issues of it.
Absolutely. Yeah. I was a total adventure character fan back before I became an adventure character pro. And, you know, so I read all the Doc Savage paperbacks. So did Roy Thomas, obviously. I mean, you know, when Roy came to me, and, you know, when I was working at Marvel, and he said, you know, I want to hand Doc Savage off to you, I'm like, yeah, you know, sure. Plus, you know, there was some really nice art in there. I mean, Steranko was doing the covers.
You bet.
I'm sure they're going to have to reprint the covers when they do this stuff. But the interiors, you know, Ross Andrew and Tom Palmer, very nice combination.
Yep.
It was, you know, it was fun. It was real interesting to adapt those, you know, because I had just gotten into comics, and I was, you know, starting to write my own Captain America and my own Defenders and my own Avengers and whatever. But to then turn around and adapt something that I had read as a 5 years earlier or whatever was an interesting thing for a young writer to do, you know.
Very cool, man. Well, we'll look forward to that. But more importantly, The Point Man is out by Tor, and Long Man, by the time this airs, will also be out, also by Tor, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And and then next year, as you say, the third book will come out, and it's not, like you said, this is a plan to make this a continuing series now.
Yeah, it's, you know, well, Tor contracted for three new ones and the old one, and I'm certainly looking at it as running a lot longer than that. So, I mean, we will now see if they want to do more. I hope they do, and that's the plan anyway.
Fantastic. And yeah, the Long Man comes out on the 16th. Should I release this before the 16th? So look for that on that Tuesday.
Yeah.
So that's great. Hey, Steve, honestly, I took you longer than I said I was going to. So,
well, you can cut out all the parts where I...
No problem. Yeah. All of our stammers will be removed. I appreciate your time, and really, thanks for joining me. And when the next chapter comes out next year, I hope you'll come back.
Okay. Thanks for having me.
That's Steve Englehart. Make sure you check out The Long Man and The Point Man. Start with The Point Man, then go to The Long Man, the first two books in the New Max August series from Steve Englehart and Tor Books. And do yourself a favor, go back and check out Dark Detective 2 and compare the storyline to what we know about Batman the Dark Knight. Very interesting. That'll do it for this edition of Word Balloon. Thanks again for listening. John Suntress reminding you to look for Word Balloon at wordballoon.com, our website. Our archive is there of nearly 300 shows featuring great interviews with comic creators, people from film, television, animation, all waiting for you at wordballoon.com. Make sure you check out our archives. Make sure you check out our video pages as well. We've got some new content coming up in the days ahead. I think you're going to enjoy it. If you happen to listen to us via iTunes and haven't given us a review or rating, we sure would appreciate your support if you stop by and drop a line to us there. Follow me on Twitter, John Word Balloon, or on Facebook under my name, John Suntress, or you can email me your questions and comments, john@wordballoon.com.
Thanks again for listening. Until next time, Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions. Copyright 2010.